The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
I asked whether we are seeing the de-escalation that Ukraine's leaders have been hoping for.
Well, it could be, but Ukrainian authorities are careful. They have said that they do not see the final proof that they're really withdrawing yet. They're still looking at all the information, so they're really careful that, and they want to be really sure that it is really happening. Russia will be in any way. If Russia starts withdrawing now, it will also be able to bring them back quickly. So this is why Ukraine is really careful and is waiting for it. But you can feel a certain detente here anyway.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, still a lot of uncertainty. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. Good to be with you today. That report comes from Deutsche News. The Ukrainians, what a position to be in. Imagine that nation. You know, with this major military power, any moment, the threat of invasion, unsure about the movements of Russia, despite the fact that some troops have been withdrawn. Mixed signals, right? Mixed signals. I was in 2 hours of meetings right up to this show. It has been a long day. I jumped up this morning, got right into the broadcast and start working on today's show. And then I was in a whole series of meetings And here we are today. So let me see if I can get through some news for you. We got a lot to unpack today. And in fact, a little later, we'll do some spiritual stuff too. If you're going through a difficult time and you're not sure the source of the division or the conflict or the anxiety or the depression or the addiction, we're going to take a look at the spiritual underpinning of that. That's coming up a little bit later. But we got a lot to get into. Russia and Ukraine. I'll go back to them. Let's pray for them. I believe prayer changes things. It brings peace. It dispels evil. It protects. So continue to pray just for peace in the world. Our nation's officials and, of course, Ukraine's president had said today that today was the day they expected Russia would attack Ukraine. And early this morning when I got up and got plugged into some news, I'd seen that it had not happened. And I said, thanks be to God. At least it hasn't happened today. It's not to say it can't happen tomorrow or at some other time. ABC News and Wall Street Journal both reported that there are still Russian troop buildups going on along the Ukraine border. Now, are they simple exercises? Or as I said yesterday, was this part of the head fake of Vladimir Putin? ABC was saying that the troops are in firing position, despite the fact that Moscow is claiming that, hey, we're withdrawing troops. We're sending them back to their home bases after these exercises. So officials are still trying to determine the source of yesterday's cyber attack on Ukraine's defense ministry and army and several banks. That normally a precursor to an invasion or something else. You put the nation into chaos. Interestingly, though, I mean, cyber attacks are increasing here in the U.S. as well. And they weren't sure whether that was Russia. Some said it could have been hackers. Maybe it was. The Huron Daily Tribune in Bad Axe, Michigan, right? It's a little small town in the thumb of Michigan's peninsula. They were reporting that their country's IT guy, he received a notice from the Department of Homeland Security to watch for cyber attacks. So he checked the systems, and their attacks increased from a couple hundred an hour. Check this out. To several hundred thousand an hour. I mean, that's incredible, right? So, and this is a country with, this is a county, I should say, with only about 53,000 people in it. So what exactly that means, it's not clear to me. I don't know the significance of that particular location or why the Department of Homeland Security would personally notify them, but apparently they knew something was going on. So, I think that, and I said to my wife, maybe we should get some water, get some food, fill up the cars with some gas. And I don't want to scare people, but if for some reason Vladimir Putin does go into Russia and U.S. responds with sanctions, very likely we could see cyber attacks here in our own country. You remember what happened with the Colonial Pipeline and a lot of the other things that we've seen. It really showed our vulnerability. Look at the chaos that caused up and down the East Coast. Look what happened to fuel prices. That's just one pipeline. And I'm sure a nation as strong and as gifted with their computer and hacking capabilities could do a lot more havoc. We would, of course, return the favor. There would be a reciprocal attack, I'm sure. And I'm sure it just would not be good. We don't want to see that escalate. But what would that mean to you if you run out of food or power went out and your refrigerator, you know, couldn't keep your food safe anymore, or you ran out of gas? You know, there's a lot of considerations here. So just throwing that out. I pray to God nothing happens. I haven't gone to the store yet to do it. And let's just pray that this situation de-escalates. Our neighbors to the north have been following this story, too, and keeping you abreast of what's going on there. That's still developing. We talked yesterday about the invocation of the Emergency Act, and that is leading to police in Ottawa being able to be more aggressive, if you will, in clearing out protesters. And to federal police now given authority in the city, which they didn't have before. So the CBC there reported that police are going to establish these no-go zones in the city, you know, down in the city's downtown, kind of the core to control the crowds associated with this convoy and this protest. And anybody who defies those orders, you are going to face fines. You're going to face possibly jail time or even both. So the city's public safety minister said that authorities will move to erect more concrete barriers and press private tow truck companies into removing these big rigs that have clogged up the streets. So the CBC also reported that the government is threatening to suspend corporate bank accounts and also commercial licensing for truckers taking part in the convoy. That's somebody's livelihood right there, their commercial licensing. So for a government that says, you know, hey, we support peaceful protests, they're coming down with a hammer, that's for sure. Fox went to the streets of New York City yesterday, and New Yorkers, they were flooding the streets near the Canadian consulate and showing their support for the Freedom Convoy. Here's what some of the people were saying. Listen to this.
Out here supporting the Canadian truckers in Ottawa, the Canadian people. It's a peaceful, amazing working class revolution, and I'm just astonished that the legacy left media is not covering at all or acting like this thing is something that it's not. It's multicultural, it's diverse, it has to do with resisting authoritarianism, and Trudeau has shown his true colors. He is clearly a World Economic Forum authoritarian who doesn't care about the people.
What the Canadian truckers are doing is just amazing. It's amazing for all of us all around the world. Everyone who's affected by the mandates.
Just end the mandates. That's all we want. I don't understand. It's a bigger agenda than what's being proposed.
We're ultimately here for our freedom.
I'm here to support the Canadians. I'm here to support New Yorkers for health choices of their own and to support the people that have lost their jobs due to these mandates, which are really unjust.
You know, I sit back and I think the irony of how things change. You know, if you just turn the hands of the clock back, let's just go back months, maybe a year. Remember during the height of the pandemic, truckers were considered heroes, right? They were braving the pandemic. They were on the roads. They were delivering all those Amazon products that you were buying, delivering food and things to your home. You know, they were critical workers. So were a lot of doctors and nurses and other people. Hey, you fast forward to where we are today, and these people are no longer heroes. They're zeros. Right, if they don't like the mandate or they didn't get the shot, suddenly they're zeros. They're enemies of the state. It's really wild. It was eye opening to me too. Where were these emergency measures when a lot of protests were happening in 2020? You know, we can talk a lot more about it. Ed Marcy is going to be joining me coming up here in a minute. And I want to fill you in on some other big news, too, just here in our own home. But before I do, I have a friend who's looking for a home right now. And I saw a report that actually really surprised me. Average mortgage price. I don't know if you're thinking of selling your home or buying. We know last year, right after the pandemic, I guess people wanted a change, or they decided to work from home, or they wanted to move to another city. I don't know what drove the real estate pike. But after yesterday's inflation report that we talked about, a little bit more news for you that, may not sit so well. The average new mortgage, check this out, is now $453,000. $453,000. That's a record. Along with the fact that interest rates went up, they were at 3.83%. They're now 4.05%. So they're on the climb. I think they're going to continue to go up. It's still a great interest rate. I mean, if you think of a 4% interest rate a couple years ago, you would have done the happy dance to get that. But when they were in threes and twos and now you're paying four, I know it can be hard to swallow. So according to CNBC, you know, housing prices, they're up about 18% at the end of December from a year earlier. Because of that, not a lot of people are wanting to refinance their homes. And applications for refinancing actually went down 54% from last year. Here's what CNBC had to say about those rising mortgage rates.
Mortgage News Daily, take a look. We have crossed over into the fours. So it's a reaction, of course, to the CPI report and the resulting jump in the yield on the 10-year Treasury. Mortgage rates loosely follow that. So by comparison, the rate is now 122 basis points higher than it was a year ago when it was at 2.8%. That is significant purchasing power lost for home buyers right on the cusp of the spring season. So if you're buying the median price house right now, you'll be paying about $250 a month more than you would have just a year ago. And that's real money, especially given inflation and how much more we're paying for everything else in the monthly budget these days.
Yeah, it's wild. I saw, you know, used cars, the price of meat, you know, mortgages. It's the economy. You know, I know it's giving a lot of people calls, and it's not just home prices. Rent is also going up. You might say, well, I just rent, or gosh, I'm going to move. I think I'll rent for a while. I saw a report earlier today. I think it was Redfin who did the study. They found that rent jumped 14% in December of last year. It was about $1,877 a month. That's the largest rise in more than 2 years. In Austin, Texas, there was a 40% increase in rental prices. 40%. Austin, Texas. That city is booming. New York had a 35% increase. A lot of people were leaving that city. Remember that, though? And then, of course, several metro areas in Florida, they exceeded 30% increases. But some of those southern states, like Texas and others, a lot of people are moving there. A lot of people are renting. According to experts, a lot of this all has to do with the demand that's exceeding the supply. And there are apparently just not enough housing to go around. So what's causing that isn't clear. But you'll probably hear something more about that in the days ahead. We'll continue to take a look at it. All right, we'll follow it for you. I saw an article earlier today. Ed Marcy, and I hope you'll follow him. He wrote a great piece, and the headline was this: It was Politico. Sliding Biden hits a new morning consult low on pandemic, and that ain't all. And as I went through this, I thought, man, Ed made a lot of really great points. There's a political tracking group. It's called Morning Consult, and they keep their finger on the pulse of how Americans are feeling about whoever is sitting in the White House. And the current issue of the day right now, how the current occupant, you know, at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is dealing for them. And as you know, I've been following this, you probably have been plugged in too. The president's poll numbers are terrible. They're not looking good. When he campaigned for office, do you remember, I was saying this to my wife this morning. I talked about the Republican and the Democratic convention. Two totally different messages. You know, one was very hopeful. One was about how bad COVID was and we're having a dark winter. And apparently it resonated with America. He campaigned on that platform that I'm going to end the pandemic. And America said, you know what, Joe, we need you. We need to get out of this pandemic. They took him at his word. They voted for him. 13 months later, Morning Consult found that just 39% of registered voters approved of the job that he was dealing with and how he's handling all this. 57% disapproved. So CNN released a poll a few days ago about President Biden's ratings as well. It was pretty eye-opening. Take a listen.
This is fascinating. We asked people, what has President Biden done for you that you approve of? 56% of Americans, nearly 6 in 10 Americans, that means a decent amount of Democrats said nothing. They disapprove of everything that has happened. Now, yes, the president would say, we passed the rescue plan. We passed the bipartisan infrastructure plan. It is not sinking in out in America. 56% of Americans say nothing. They disapprove of everything that has happened so far. 15% say the president has helped with the economy. 6% say the coronavirus. You see here personal traits, foreign policy, other issues. But that is a stunning number of the failure to communicate of the Biden administration and to the inflation and the economy. Just look at the line here. The president's approval rating on the economy was 49% back in March. It is down 12 points to 37%. Disapproval on the economy, 44% in March. 62% of Americans disapprove of the president's handling of the economy because they are paying more at the grocery store and at the pump every day.
You get what you get who you vote for. I mean, Again, you know, he's dealing with pandemics. We're dealing with variants. A lot of factors people can argue played into this. But the key word in that report was nothing, right? I mean, even the Democrats' own internal polling is showing bad ratings. Politico reported that those polls also showed some battleground voters, right, and what they think of the current party. And they think that the party's preachy. It's judgmental. It's focused on culture wars. Let's talk about it. Ed Marcy joins me today, senior editor at hotair.com, one of the great voices you'll hear here when I'm gone. I'm so grateful for him taking the mic. And if you want to check out his piece, you'll link over to it on our Twitter page as well. Just type in Marcy. You'll probably find it on Politico. Sliding Biden hits a new morning consult low on the pandemic, and that ain't all. Hey, Ed, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Thanks for having me on.
Great piece. I found it very enlightening. Big day today too for just numbers and where the president is. Not many people like Trump. I mean, let me rephrase that. That's not true. I mean, we were a deeply divided country. But I'm just curious about his numbers. Did the president's numbers ever look this bad? Was there a moment during his presidency that they were this low?
Well, I think probably they were close. Right. I mean, I think that Donald Trump's numbers really started to bottom out in the first, maybe the second year of his presidency prior to the midterms. They bounced back up after that. And I think during the pandemic, again, they went back down because people were very put off by the chaos around the President Trump's response to COVID. Now, I think that that was a matter of taste. And I think that's part of the reason why Biden was able to turn out so many people and narrowly win that election, even while his party was losing seats in the House, was in large part a reaction to sort of that chaos agent element in Trump's presidency. But clearly, though, I think voters are seeing that the chaos really hasn't abated, and neither has the pandemic, and in large part because the administration is still imposing these top-down interventions that are preventing them from being able to operate. And that's coming directly from the White House. So I think that it's not just a sense that there's a messaging issue here, which is the way that John King framed it in CNN in your clip there, but there's an actual performance issue here. There's a trust issue. There's a confidence issue that's going on here as well, based on the fact that they're just hasn't delivered on these promises. And this is part of what happens when you set expectations to a certain level and can't meet them.
I was wondering what the conflict with Ukraine would do. I mean, I would assume that was going to bump his numbers. But I sat back and said, well, look, I want to be fair. I mean, is there anything good that the Biden administration has done? I mean, we have real problems on our border. We see an increase in fentanyl and carfentanyl-related deaths. You know, we know that China's pumping this fentanyl into the cartels, and they're getting it across the border. We were humiliated internationally with Afghanistan. We've seen what he's done with our Keystone Pipeline. You know, there's so many different things. We see inflation. We see his pro-death agenda coming after the state of Texas. And I mean, we can go on and on. I don't want to keep highlighting. I'm thinking, you know, what is there that he's done positively? Because, you know, those numbers are low, but it's really hard for me to think of something that's been really positive over the past, you know, year that the Biden administration has done that they can camp out on. I mean, midterms are going to be here in, what, 265 days? They're right around the corner. They're not that far away, 10 months away. And I'm wondering how this is all going to play out. I mean, maybe the war will be, maybe the threat of war strengthens his position. Maybe there'll be something else. I don't know. I'd love your thoughts.
Well, I don't think that Ukraine's really going to budge the polls too much here. Although I will say that I think that they have finally sort of landed on the best possible position to play a bad hand in Ukraine, which is to focus potential sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which they had been unwilling to do earlier on, which sent really terrible signals. This is the Ukraine mess is this stretches back 30 years. We have made a series of bad decisions in Ukraine, in Georgia, and all these frontier these countries on the frontier of Russia that used to be part of the Soviet Union. In part because I think that we just thought that the fall of the Soviet Union meant the end of Russian imperialism. Russian imperialism stretches back centuries. And I don't think we were realistic about that. And I think that that's a failing of administrations of both parties. So in that sense, I think he's playing a bad hand, and he's probably doing it as as best as you can do it now. But I don't think that Americans are going to make a decision based on Ukraine. They're not going to make a voting decision based on Ukraine. They're going to make a voting decision based on pocketbook issues.
Yeah, I agree. And
when you have inflation running away like it is, triggered in large part by Joe Biden's third COVID stimulus bill, which Larry Summers warned about at the time would create that kind of inflationary wave. That and crime are two issues that touch American lives every single day. And those are the two issues I think that Democrats probably should really be mostly worried about. I don't see them formulating a policy response to either. And I think that that's going to be a big problem for them.
No, I think you're right. I remember hearing over and over again, inflation is transitory. It wasn't transitory. I keep hearing over and over, they're going to, you know, it's going to beat COVID. We're going to get out of this dark winter. We're still dealing with COVID and a lot of the variants. I didn't expect Ukraine to move the polls for him for the elections. But I just normally when there's threat of war or we get into international type of conflicts, a president's numbers always tick up a little bit. But based on what you're reporting here, 39% of registered voters approve of the job he's doing just in general. Those are remarkably low. So is there anything that the Democrats can do to change that trajectory? I mean, do they have, anything to show the people and say, hey, look, this is what we've done. This is what we're going to do. Or, hey, hang out with us here. This is all going to change. Inflation is transitory. Gas prices are going to come down. What's the messaging here?
It's going to have to be beyond messaging. Messaging isn't the issue. Again, it's really about results. It's about how people are feeling. And I really should throw in COVID as the third thing that people are dealing with every single day. Yeah, voters are dealing with every single day. And in COVID, I mean, I think you're framing this right, is that there were just some things that weren't popping up at the time and are now, but it was predictable that we were going to be dealing with variants. And I don't think that either administration really prepared people well for the idea of variants and how impactful that was going to be. And I think that both, in 2020, both parties were running on, COVID's going to go away. We're going to defeat COVID and all this. Right. Just talking about different ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. And look, this is endemic. It's going to be with us forever. We're going to have to learn to live with it. And if people were talking about that and delivering on that, I think they would have been in a far better position on other things, but they've squandered credibility across a wide range of issues here. And I don't think they can get it back in time for the midterm elections.
Yeah. State of the Union address is coming up soon.
Yep.
What do you expect there? What's that going to be like?
Well, I think that you're going to have President Biden trying to address some of these issues, trying to rebuild some credibility. I think he's going to defend it's going to be a typical State of the Union speech. It's a little later than most State of the Union speeches, and I think that they were kind of hoping to be able to roll back some of the CDC guidelines around that as sort of a centerpiece to boost interest in the speech. But with so many states now just deciding to act on their own to roll these things back, and it's really going to be an anticlimax when the CDC finally gets around to updating its guidelines here. I suspect that it's going to be, as it usually is, to be fair, it's going to be just another political speech, and it probably won't have a lot of impact. Yeah.
Well, I loved your piece, and I know people can find it. What's the best way to connect to it, and what will people find in it? You want to give them a quick tease?
Sure, yeah. You go to hideair.com, and I mean, Drew, you really kind of covered all the great stuff that I would have put in there. I would say pay very close attention to the fact that the culture war aspects of this that Democrats are losing on a broad basis and how damaging it is to their position in battleground states, because those are issues like parental rights, the COVID issues. Those types of things are also going to drive voter turnout. And it's the turnout model that you really have to be looking at.
Yeah, it'll be very telling. We'll see how they what the talking points are to counter defunding police and all the other things that we are currently seeing. Ed, great job on the piece. Thank you for always being here for us. Always good to talk with you, and we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you so much, Drew.
That's Ed Morrissey. Again, hotair.com. You can check him out there. Check out his piece. I scratch the surface of it. There's a lot more into it. He breaks down Dem voters and the culture wars and so much of the other stuff we talked about. I have to take a short pause. Speaking of some of bad policies, voters in San Francisco. Wait till you hear what happened to some school members there. Don't go away. School board members, I should say. Today's programming is brought to you by St. Gregory Recovery Center in Iowa. More information about their faith-centered addiction treatment is available at relevantradio.com/stgregory.
Well, yesterday, San Francisco voters participated in the long-awaited special municipal election to recall three members of the school board, Gabriela Lopez, Allison Collins, and Fauga Maliga. As expected, the recall was successful, and now Democratic Mayor London Breed, who endorsed the recall, will appoint their successors. This is a prime example of the progressive left going so ridiculously far on woke culture battles that they actually completely neglected the needs of working families and engendered a backlash among conservatives, but also liberals, moderates, independents, really like anyone to the right of Robin DiAngelo, for anyone who was disappointed with the utterly misplaced priorities of the nation's worst education officials. This recall is deeply satisfying because of all the madness that Democratic-controlled school boards and teachers union-beholden politicians have wrought during the pandemic. Nothing holds a candle to San Francisco schools.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, how true is that? That was the Hill Rising reporting on the recall of San Francisco school board members after outcry from parents of every walk of life in that city. Hey, bad fruit, right? This is the fruit. This is the product of bad seeds. You put bad policies into effect, you're going to get bad results. And we see this across the board. I talked about what happened when contraception began to become embraced. And what was the bad fruit of that? We see how it has led, of course, to abortion. And then, of course, you know, as you begin to accept a culture of death, it's easy to accept euthanizing the elderly, right? When you redefine marriage, what's the bad fruit of that? What's the bad seed of that? When you allow, when you take a millennial old, you know, belief that marriage is between one man and one woman, you redefine it. Well, you're going to see, well, if that goes, two men or two women can marry. Why can't a man and a boy, or why can't a man marry five women, or, you know, one woman marry five men, right? I mean, you have polyamory, you have polygamy, you've got all these different, you've got bad fruit. And that's what happens with these policies of defunding police, with what's happening in the schools, with critical race theory. Eventually, you know, evil always collapses. And I think these bad policies are the same. They just won't stand. They just won't stand. And you know, we generally don't have elections in the middle of February in this country. And if there are, you know, they're usually, you know, for something local that only applies to that city or state. But you may not be aware of this. There was one yesterday. It was in San Francisco, and it actually does have some national implications. It was a special election asking voters if they wanted to recall three members of the city school board. And under California law, an elected official has to serve a certain amount of time before he or she could be subjected to a recall election. So only three of the members had reached that threshold. And I'm willing to bet that if all the members could have been on the ballot, they would have been, and they probably would have been voted out of office, all of them. As it was, those three that were up, the three who were on the ballot, well, they lost their jobs last night. While official, you know, tallies aren't available yet, the projections are that 70%, I don't mean to laugh, it's just 70%, 70% of the voters wanted them gone. I mean, how bad of a job did you have to do to get 7 out of 10 people to say, you're out, we're going to come out for the special election, we want you out? That comes, just to give you perspective, after the board was doing this crazy stuff, like trying to rename the schools that were named after, like, white supremacists like George Washington. Right? I mean, they go back and they want to rename the schools of, you know, named after founding fathers. Abraham Lincoln. What? The Great Emancipator? Oh, I can't have that. He was a white supremacist. You know, they were accusing Asian Americans of using white supremacy to get ahead and dropping the admission standards of one of the city's most prominent high schools, all while the pandemic was going on and they weren't paying attention to the needs of the kids. So this comes on the heels of last November's election in Virginia, where I think the entire nation got a wake-up call. Parents voted out a lot of school board members who were pushing for critical race theory, right? They wanted that taught. And, of course, in what is traditionally a very blue state, they voted in a new governor who explicitly ran on the platform of just opposing this whole idea of woke theory, right? He just, let's give power back to the parents. Let's not buy into, you know, this whole cultural ideology of wokeism. And it comes after the Justice Department said that they would start looking at whether parents who question their school boards would be considered terrorists. Remember that? You question a school board and you're a terrorist? This is the United States of America, right? This is the land of the free. Is that free? You question a school board member and you're now a terrorist. That was insane. The parents had enough. And that was it. You know, they kicked the beehive. You know, they poked the bear in the eye. And we saw what happened there. And now we're seeing it on the other side of the nation. And I think this is going to play out in the months ahead. I'm joined today by Noelle Mehring. She's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the editor for TheologyOfHome.com. And again, check that site out. Good site, TheologyOfHome.com. We've had her on many times. She wrote a book. And if you want to better understand, you know, wokeism and this progressive ideology that has polluted the popular thinking of our day, she wrote a book called Awake Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. Tam Publications is putting that out. You know, I think it's Tan. I don't know what the website is, but just search for Tan or go on to Amazon or to some other Catholic bookstore and ask for it. Noelle, it's good to have you back. Thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
Hey, what is Tan's website? I'm sure you know it. I don't mean not to.
It's tanbooks.org.
Tanbooks.org. Okay, tanbooks.org. I wasn't sure it was .org, .com. And, of course, your books are available, I'm sure, in any major Catholic bookstore, of course, online at all the major distributors as well, right?
That's right, yep. Anywhere books are sold, pretty much.
Now, it's good to have you back. Thanks for being here. I saw the story, and I thought, oh, man, this is very telling. San Francisco, it certainly is not an enclave for conservatism, you know, and these three members got voted out by not a close margin. It was a pretty large margin. And the mayor of the city was actually happy to see them go. Fill everyone in on what's going on, why it's relevant, not just to San Francisco, but the rest of the country.
Well, I think it's a great story, and it's making national headlines because it really defies a popular or sort of a woke narrative that the people who are opposing this are kind of fringe, maybe religious zealots or, you know, racists, even worse, because San Francisco, you certainly can't pigeonhole 70% of the voters who voted to vote these women out as being any of those, fitting in any of those categories, one of the most progressive cities in the nation. Right. And I think what we're seeing is that, as you were saying with the redefinition of marriage, we have redefined what education is in this country. And that's affecting not just ourselves, but our children. And I think we can ignore a lot of, or just go along with a lot of this manipulation and all of the woke stuff that's been directed at us for so long. But once you start seeing it targeted at your children, right, that sort of manipulation, right, and abuse, that's when parents really start to revolt against that. This is a classic situation of ideology rubbing up against reality. So the reality is that it's one of the, there's the reading scores in San Francisco school districts are one of the worst in the state, if not the nation. And so it's just, I think, and understandably infuriating to these parents to see that education is no longer what is happening here. Their idea is to churn out activists by introducing them into radical gender ideology and the collectivist mindset of CRT and a rejection of merit. And that is really repugnant to a lot of parents because it makes it really clear that the children's interests are not what is being taken into consideration here.
It's really sad that is what they are pushing and how they are, you know, really targeting now a very vulnerable demographic, our kids, right? So a number of parents, they're upset. They want to take power into their own hand. Some are pulling them from the schools, sending them to other institutions, or we're seeing a rise in homeschooling. That's increased very significantly over the last, I guess, year and a half. And Catholic school enrollment has gone up, too. I think it was something like almost 4% this year. But that's a turnaround from previous years of decline. And I don't know whether it's the pandemic, parents realize, hey, I can do this, or whether people are fed up with what we're seeing in areas like San Francisco. Are people going to be bailing the ship of public education even more as we go along? Are our parents saying, hey, enough is enough? And by their exodus, they're sending a pretty loud message. We're seeing what's happening to the school boards here. So are we at a tipping point?
I really think so. And I think it's a convergence of those things you all said. It's the failure of the school system in San Francisco in particular to have a practical plan for getting school kids off Zoom. But it's also this kind of doubling down on the radicalizing that has been exposed, I think, in some ways because of the Zoom, because parents have been more aware of what teachers are saying. We've seen student mental health go plummeting throughout all of this. And so it's sort of laying bare what's been happening all along. Not to mention the discovery that happened in Virginia of all sorts of pornographic, really radical gender books being placed in school libraries and also promoted by teachers to kids as young as kindergarten. So I think it's a combination of all those things, and we're going to start seeing, yes, this fleeing, I think, from the public schools, rightly so. And I think the schools will probably pivot to some degree in order to sort of stop that flood of exodus. But it won't be a genuine pivot, because I think unless we have, you know, it would be a political pivot, right? It'll be to save face or to try to patch up the dam. But truly, the ideology is so deeply embedded that it's hard to imagine a real shift and restoration of public schools unless there's, a dramatic dramatic replacement of a lot of teachers or, you know, what have you. But until then, I think parents are awakened up to this and are going to make other choices now.
So my guest today is Noelle Mehring. If you want to join us, I want to open the phones to give you an opportunity to sound off or share your experience or ask your questions, offer your insights. You can get in at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Noelle's the author of Awake, Not Woke, and it'd be good to check that out. So, you know, when we saw what happened with Youngkin in Virginia, and now we're seeing what's happening in San Francisco, I wonder if there is a reverberation across the country. Are public school educators getting the message, and will we see change as a result of that? Or is there a certain intellectual blindness, you know, a dimming of the intellect, and they're so deeply rooted in this position that they think that, you know, San Francisco and Virginia are anomalies?
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination. You know, some people just are parroting a script, but there's a lot of real believers. And it's a really incredibly difficult, once you've fully bought into an ideology, to start to see grounds, to, you know, that you could be incorrect in some ways. Because this type of ideology is really built on having an enemy. You know, it's built on division. And that is a really intoxicating thing that people let go of are loath to let go of. But to recalibrate and to rethink how you've been thinking about education or all these things requires that sort of humility and, the light being brought into a place that has been darkened. But I think, you know, as you said in the beginning about the, you know, parents resisting this movement being labeled as terrorists, that reminds me of there's an Orwell quote that says that ideology operates based on fraud and force. And once the fraud is exposed, they go purely to force. And that's what seems to me, that there's going to be a counter kind of movement that is really that forceful, demonizing government, top-down, demonizing of parents as terrorists, all of that type of thing, that really is going to try to maybe clamp down on this. But the more and the larger and the more courageous the resistance is to this that we're seeing from Virginia to San Francisco, then the better chance we have of defeating that.
So if you could identify one thing, what was the trigger? What has turned parents around so suddenly? Was it CRT? What were the policies? Was it renaming the schools? I mean, I'd love your take on what brought about this rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, I think in San Francisco, it was the combination of how poorly the testing was, combined with kids coming home, and that just created an intensity, I think, because a lot of San Francisco families are dual income, and so all of a sudden you're homeschooling, you know, there's all of a sudden your lives are thrown into total chaos. And you're seeing, I mean, in the Los Angeles school district, they said we won't reopen schools until we have things like Medicare for all, and we take away funding for charter schools. I mean, the goals were so political without the children's interest in mind. And I think that serves as a real wake-up call. But I do think that CRT has put things on steroids as well, because, you know, with COVID, all of a sudden we saw the riots in the street unmasked, and everybody justified them, or, you know, the mainstream media was justifying them. And I think a lot of people thought this is too much to accept. None of it makes sense. And it's gone too far. And that really started something.
Well, I've got to take a short pause. When we come back, we'll talk more. I'll open the phones if you want to get in. Love to hear from you again. Maybe if you're a school teacher, too, and you've seen this type of stuff. I don't know how you've dealt with it. You know, I have a sister-in-law that's a school teacher, and she wants to retire early. because of what she's seeing. So, hey, you can get in right now. 888-914-9149. The Chapel of the Divine Mercy is about 15 minutes away. We've got a lot more conversation and a full program. Stay with me. I'm back right after this. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your life connected.
Great to be with you today. Taking a look at what happened in the city of San Francisco, where board members were being voted out. And we saw what happened in Virginia. A lot of parents were fed up with the school board there pushing critical race theory, and they voted in a new governor. And we saw what happened. And of course, if you're just joining me, we're talking a little bit of what had just yesterday happened in San Francisco. And you might think it's local, but it really isn't. It has national implications. And again, we see the issue of race. You know, this talk of white supremacy being pushed. It's kind of the mantra. You know, nobody wants to be, you know, viewed as a racist. And my guest today, Noel Mehring, wrote a book. It's called Awake Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. It's available at tanbooks.org if you want to check it out. She joins me today. And I want to go to the phones, but before I do, just want to pick up on this issue of white supremacy, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is they were accusing some Asian Americans of being white supremacists in San Francisco. You want to unpack that?
That's right. I think Asian Americans have been political footballs for the woke movement. You know, they identify them as being white adjacent when they oppose the ideology, and that they identify them as being racial minorities when they support. So, but what happened was there's a really a school called Lowell that's very difficult to get into, and it had a merit-based entrance, and they were trying to do away with that merit-based. Because they said it was discriminatory. However, half the population, the student body, was non-white, and of that half, 75% are Asian Americans. And so I think that they realized pretty quickly this is going to be discriminatory against us. I think the idea is that it's such a hopeless concept to eliminate the concept of merit in children's minds, students' minds, because merit tells them I can transcend my circumstances, I can work hard and connect that to some outcome. And that really doesn't serve well the ideology. The ideology wants you to think that everything in your life is attributable to a systemic injustice. But what they do is they take the phrase white supremacy and they attach that onto anything that is opposed to the woke revolutionary ideology. That's what that means at this point. It doesn't actually refer to actual racism so much as it refers to not being supportive of woke ideology.
And how do you fight back against that very quickly if you can? Because it's... Yeah, nobody wants to be considered a racist. People all of a sudden they bend over backwards to go out of their way to prove that they're not. What's the proper disposition when attacked like that?
Well, at this point, I think it's been so exposed to be a fraud that I think the proper response is to not be bullied by it. I think we felt that so kowtowed and silenced by that label for so long because it's used so broadly and so unjustly. But that really does a disservice to actual racism. You know, if we're calling everything racism, then what does that mean when something actually happens that is racist? How do we really oppose that as we're called to as Christians when the word has been so denuded by this abuse of it?
It's a great way of putting it. John's listening in New Jersey. He's a teacher. Love to hear what he has to say. John, hi. You're on the air with Noel Mehring. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Yes, I'm 20 years teaching in a large city in New Jersey in a district. And what I'm seeing is the brand new teachers, the ones that are just coming out of their degrees from college, in their 20s, in their early 30s, are afraid of losing their careers, and they are giving in to the ideological expectations of the hiring district. These teachers are unable to speak out because they're afraid. They must include ideology material in their subject matter, and this is the problem that I'm experiencing.
Great insight. John, thank you. Noel, I'll let you respond.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. And I think that is happens so often. It's that sort of, it's a bullying tactic, you know, that's just bully people into silence. And a lot of these teachers are good-willed and oftentimes really just want to do education because they love education and they care about students. But I think the system so breaks down their impulses to kind of have a free sort of education oriented towards truth by pressuring them to become activists and people who train activists that they don't know how to do, and they really feel what to do from there, and they really must feel stuck. And my heart really goes out to those teachers.
Is it the teachers? Is it the teachers' union that pushed this ideology, and the politicians? Who's the blame? Is it the university formation? I mean, are these kids coming out of now a more liberal formation and going into classes and teaching? I mean, maybe it's one, maybe it's all those things. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a combination of them. In my book, I get into it a bit in one chapter about education, but the revolutionaries really understood that it was not going to be, you know, we were not going to revolutionize the West just on economic terms. And one of the tactics was, let's get into the school system, mm-hmm. universities, obviously, but it's also, but also K through 12. And so a lot of really radicalized people in the 60s started training, you know, even people from the Weather Underground went on to have cushy chairs at teachers' colleges, where they would train people, you know, representatives from every school district, and they'd go back and disseminate all this ideology into their districts. And I think that slow chipping away has just really, in time, you know, given a lot of control to this radical ideology. They were right that you slowly can capture these institutions, and eventually you have a lot of power once you do.
Hey, John, thanks for the call. Thanks for saying yes to being a good teacher. We need you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Noel, I only have a couple minutes left here. When I began the conversation, I was just reflecting on the bad fruit that we see from so many bad ideologies, you know, contraception, abortion, euthanasia, redefinition of marriage. I mean, you go through the litany of these types of things. Eventually, this stuff all collapses on itself. I mean, it just can't stand, you know, it's rotten. Are we now beginning to see the collapse of these ideological ideas? Are people beginning to see the bad fruit of them? Or do you think we're going to be, having to digest this for a little longer?
I do feel hopeful. I mean, I think that we're seeing, you know, resistance to this on multiple levels all over the place. And it does seem like there's been a shift over the past year. So I'm an optimist by nature. So, you know, I think my natural state is to be hopeful. But I think, as you said, you know, the human person is made for truth and for goodness and for beauty. And that's what we long for. And this ideology is thin. It's, you know, built on lies and ugliness and hatred. And that does not satisfy people for long, you know, it just makes us miserable. And so I think that the natural human desire for, you know, free thinking, the free thinking that is needed in order to pursue the truth, is what really what people long for. And that's where you see a lot of vibrancy and vitality in institutions and in, you know, even shows or your show like yours, where people are, you know, welcomed to speak what they believe and to not be afraid of being bullied into something else.
Right.
And I think human people, all people really desire that. And so that gives me a lot of hope, too.
That's great. Well, Katrina is listening in Green Bay, Wisconsin. She wants to join the conversation. She's got a thought for you. Katrina, good afternoon. You're on the air with Noel Murray.
Hi there. So, you know, I've been an anti-oppression trainer for 16 years, and I agree that as Christians, I think it's important that we focus on what is equity, you know, what is equity for all, instead of focusing on how can we combat this racism beast, especially since everybody has a different definition of racism and is working on those definitions, which many are incorrect. So I think that as Christians, we really need to focus on when there's a group of people that are crying and saying that, you know, there's injustice and we need help, instead of saying, okay, that's not us and that's not our problem, we need to look at how we can step up. And I think that is really the call of the movement, to step up and say, hey, everyone's important. So that's my comment. I actually came on for the Divine Mercy Chaplet and I heard that and I was like, oh no, Drew. So I just wanted to make that comment. I feel like people could be really discouraged and get the wrong idea from what you and your guests are saying.
All right, well, Katrina, thanks. Why don't you hang out and we'll get you on the air to pray for your intention as well. All right, we only have a few moments, Noel, so I'll let you respond first if you'd like.
Yeah, thanks for your comment. I hear you. And I think that's what we've been doing for a long time, is just trying to think, well, we want to listen to people who've been marginalized and suffering. And I think that's obviously clearly a good and Christian precept. But what matters is not, you know, that we posture that we care the most, but that we actually are doing policies and acting in ways that actually help people. And the concept of equity, I think it's really not a Christian concept. The idea that we can get to a place where there's equality of outcome, despite any other variable, it doesn't empower people. It actually weakens them. And I think it harms the people we most want to help. And so what we believe is an equality of the dignity of the human person. And equity is really rooted in a Marxist ideology that is antithetical to Christ.
So I agree with equality of opportunity. I don't agree with quality of equity of outcome, but I agree with equity of opportunity. And I think, like you said, that's what we're really looking for, equity of opportunity.
Thank you, Katrina. I think we're on the same page with that. I would agree with equity of opportunity. And I do think it is our responsibility as Christians, as followers of Christ, to denounce racism wherever it is and stand up for what is right and just. If you want to read a great book, check out Noel Mehring's book. It's called Awake, Not Woke. It's a Christian response to the cult of progressive ideology. A lot of what you're seeing in a lot of different strata today in our society and our culture. Noel, thank you for your time. Thank you for your insight and for your eloquence. Always good to have you here.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Drew.
We'll catch up soon, all right? We're going to pray the Chapel of Divine Mercy. Stay with me. I'll be right back.